Fogarty.
May it please the Court. In this case, the District Court erred by permitting the government to question the defense's only witness, Sergio Sanchez, regarding Mr. Sanchez and Mr. Ozuna's gang affiliation, as well as the gang's violent practices. The government sought to introduce gang affiliation testimony in this case in an attempt to demonstrate bias on the part of Mr. Sanchez. However, the gang affiliation testimony and many of the gang references at trial were not necessary to demonstrate any bias on the part of Mr. Sanchez, and many of the gang references and much of the testimony at trial had absolutely nothing to do with Mr. Sanchez's alleged bias. What the gang affiliation testimony and repeated references did, however, was make it likely that the jury would conclude that Mr. Ozuna had a gun on the night in question because he's a gang member, and make it likely that the jury would simply convict Mr. Ozuna because he's a gang member. Now, the district court erred for three reasons. First, much of the testimony and many of the gang references had absolutely nothing to do with bias. Two, the government had at its disposal an evidentiary alternative. In fact, the district court instructed the government to inquire about this evidentiary alternative, which was Mr. Sanchez and Mr. Ozuna's admitted lifelong friendship. The government refrained from eliciting testimony about that before first eliciting testimony regarding Mr. Sanchez and Mr. Ozuna's membership in a violent street gang. And third, the district court erred because this was a close case. This was a case where one eyewitness testified that he saw Mr. Ozuna with a gun on the night in question, and one eyewitness, Mr. Sanchez, testified that he and not Mr. Ozuna had the gun on the night in question. Now, at trial, this wasn't a case of a passing reference to gang affiliation. This was a case with repeated references to gang affiliation and gang violence. In fact, many of the government's questions regarding gang testimony had nothing to do with Mr. Sanchez's bias. In fact, the government asked questions turning Mr. Sanchez's cross-examination into a discourse on gang culture and gang violence and away from whether Mr. Sanchez was lying or whether Mr. Ozuna had the gun. The government asked Mr. Sanchez, "You'd go out on the corner flashing gang signs, correct? You'd go out on the corner shouting gang slogans. You and the rest of the gang members out there shouting gang slogans, flashing gang signs." These references had nothing to do with whether Mr. Sanchez was telling the truth or not, or whether Mr. Ozuna had the gun. They were simply a way to inflame the jury and make them likely to conclude that Mr. Ozuna had a gun based on something other than proof beyond a reasonable doubt on the elements of the charged offense. The government also played up the violence or the violent conduct of these gang members. After Mr. Sanchez testified that his gang has rules and that when members violate those rules, they can be punished, the government made repeated references to the nature of that punishment, asking questions of Mr. Sanchez, such as, "It's not a slap on the wrist, right? I mean, it's serious. It's physical violence, isn't it? They'll beat you for violating rules, right? You don't want people to beat on you, right? It's fair to say, in a violation, that's a physical beating, correct?" Again, playing on fears and the jury's disdain for gang members. The cross-examination wasn't about whether Mr. Sanchez was telling the truth or whether Mr. Ozuna had the gun. It was about whether Mr. Ozuna and Mr. Sanchez were gang members. And finally, after the government sought to introduce testimony to establish that Mr. Sanchez and Mr. Ozuna's gang had rules requiring junior members to lie on behalf of more senior members. Now, Mr. Sanchez denied that, and the government had no other evidence or no other testimony to suggest that the gang had such rules. Nevertheless, the government, after Mr. Sanchez had denied it, asked 9 follow-up questions, asserting as fact that the gang had such rules and that Mr. Sanchez would be violently beat if he didn't indeed lie for Mr. Ozuna. All of this was particularly problematic in this case because the government had an alternative means of demonstrating any alleged bias on the part of Mr. Sanchez. In fact, before the government's cross-examination, the district court instructed the government to use Mr. Sanchez and Mr. Ozuna's lifelong friendship and refrain from using the gang affiliation testimony. The district court said, you've got the relationship. They consider themselves brothers, together with a variety of things. You could possibly have something they were doing that night. All that is open. The gang membership is not. The government didn't ask any questions about the two men, about their relationship, before first establishing that they were gang members. Now, the government has argued that Mr. Sanchez opened the door to this testimony. Mr. Sanchez didn't. He didn't once deny that he was, before the gang affiliation evidence or testimony came out, he didn't deny that he was friends with Mr. Ozuna. He didn't deny that he was loyal to Mr. Ozuna. The government jumps on Mr. Sanchez's response or testimony that the gang or that the gun belonged to an organization that he belonged to. First, the fact that the gun in question belonged to Mr. Sanchez's organization doesn't make it more or less likely that Mr. Ozuna had the gun. And similarly, the fact that Mr. Sanchez is in an organization doesn't make it more or less likely that he would lie for Mr. Ozuna. And the fact that he belongs to an organization cannot open the door to repeated references about violence and menacing conduct in the community. And all of this together in the context of a close case. The government cites a number of cases for the proposition that gang evidence is admissible to demonstrate bias on the part of a witness. They cite cases like Wilson, like Abel. This case is different because there are repeated references to violence, and it's a close case. It's a case with one eyewitness to one eyewitness. In Wilson, there were two eyewitnesses. There was evidence that he admitted to having the gun. Here, there's no admission. There's one witness, Officer Staunton, and one witness, Sergio Sanchez. And Officer Staunton's story is not without its faults. Officer Staunton first claims that he was able to see which man had the gun as soon as he arrived on the scene because they were standing in a dark alley at midnight, Sergio Sanchez and Mr. Ozuna. And he was able to drive up that alley at 20 to 25 miles an hour without them noticing him. It's implausible. It's implausible that two men standing in an alley at midnight, knowing that the police are out looking for them, it's implausible that they wouldn't have noticed him. Second, Officer Staunton's story is directly contradicted by one of the government's own witnesses. The 911 caller, or I should say Officer Staunton, testified that he was in close proximity in continuous pursuit of the men as he chased them from the alley to the through the 911 caller's backyard into the gangway. There are other problems with Officer Staunton's story, such as it's internally inconsistent. But I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Certainly, counsel. Mr. Flanagan.
May it please the court. My name is Peter Flanagan. I represent the United States. The gang evidence obviously went to Sergio Sanchez's bias, and there's no dispute that it was relevant. The central flaw with the defendant's argument is that it fails to properly account for the probative value of this evidence. The witness here claimed possession of the defendant's gun. It was the central issue in this case. The gang evidence showed that he had ample reason to lie. It showed not just that Sanchez and the defendant were members of the same gang, but more importantly, that Sergio Sanchez swore an oath of loyalty to the defendant, called the defendant his brother, and had subjected himself to various rules that required him to prohibited cooperation with law enforcement, forbid snitching on other gang members, and prohibited testifying against other gang members. The government wasn't playing up the violence angle at trial for the purposes of dirtying up the defendant. The violence that was brought out at trial, the testimony regarding violence, dealt with the motivation of the witness to follow the rules that he had subjected himself to. It went to the fact that this witness faced substantial external pressure to lie, to falsely claim possession of this gun. The probative value of this evidence was great, and moreover, the trial court took numerous steps to prevent any unfair prejudice, including a limiting instruction that was drafted by the defendant, telling the jury that it could not consider the gang evidence in finding the defendant guilty. In addition, the trial court said that it went to great lengths to say that the parties could not refer to this gang by its proper name, the Spanish Cobras, and even went so far as to say that you couldn't refer to the gang as a gang, which was retracted only after the defendant requested that if the gang was to be referenced, that it could be called a gang. The district court made a point to say that the government could not question the witness regarding his gang tattoos, including tattoos that specifically laid out his fidelity to that he felt toward his brothers, which he had testified that he considered the defendant to be one. And finally, the district court restricted inquiry into the gang evidence until the witness opened the door.
Why do you think the government asked that question on cross-examination?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Why do you think the government asked the question about the organization on cross-examination?
Well, the record shows, and I can say with certainty, that the government was asking questions. The questions that led up to it were related to the source of the gun.
Don't you think clearly the question was asked designed to elicit the response that it got, that it was a gang, and then the door was wide open?
Well, the question that led to him saying gang, what organization is that? At that point, the government was aware that question would elicit the answer that it was a gang. However, the witness had squarely brought the gang, interjected the gang into the facts and circumstances of this offense.
But wasn't that still at the point where the district court had indicated to stay away from that?
Well, the district court repeatedly said, there's a bit of a mischaracterization of the district court's ruling. The district court said that the door may still be opened in cross-examination.
Well, my concern is, in real life, that at the sidebar, the defense counsel, as good defense counsel should do, wanted to know if it was coming up. If it was coming up, they were going to front it. And so he was preparing himself either way. If it came in, he wanted to be the one that brought it in, which would be the right defense strategy. The way it came in this way became problematic then for the defense. And I don't think problematic means it shouldn't have come in. I think it should have come in right from the beginning. But the way it came in, and I think the government, the way I saw it unfold, the government elicited that door opening.
Well, it was certainly the government's hope at the time of that sidebar. The government's position had consistently been that the door was open when this witness testified favorably for the defendant. At that sidebar, that's when the judge said that, I believe it was for the first time at that point, that the door may be open. He said that it's not open yet, the witness hasn't opened it yet, but it may still be opened on cross. If he's careful, it won't be. Words to that effect that Judge Zagel said.
Well, I see this case as a lesson for us trial court judges. Sometimes we try to accommodate both sides, have the for the defense to keep out the gang affiliation, for the prosecution to allow some examination about an organization, and it turns out the whole thing's a mess, and we should just let it in the first place, and everybody knew what it was going to be.
And, Your Honor, the trial court did ultimately say that it was a mistake to have restricted the evidence on opening the door, that the government should have been allowed to get into it right away.
My concern is, as the trial court, that one side or the other will just keep pushing until the door is open, and so we really can't try to give both sides what they want.
Probably not material, but it was not the government's desire that it unfolded in that way.
I don't know about that.
It was not, Your Honor.
Okay.
As far as this being a close case, there were multiple witnesses testifying on behalf of the government regarding the events of that evening. Four of them, Sergio Sanchez managed to contradict four of them, all four of them that were there that night. The most significant contradiction was in the fact that this wasn't just a case between one officer who saw the defendant with a gun and Sergio Sanchez. There were multiple witnesses, including, I think it's particularly noteworthy that Officer Nestorowicz, the officer who recovered the gun, testified that he recovered the gun within seconds of learning of it from the officer who saw the defendant with the gun. And the only reason why he would have been able to recover that gun so quickly and to even know to look for a gun is because Officer Staunton saw the defendant with the gun and saw him throw it. In addition, counsel mentioned that or suggested that, that Officer Staunton's testimony was contradicted by the 911 caller, Individual A. That's not the case. She merely testified that she saw the witness briefly peeking up through the window, saw him flashing a flashlight into the backyard. He was stopped, according to her, in the driveway. She also testified this was just a brief look. Officer Staunton, the officer who saw the defendant with the gun, throw the gun, said that when he saw him throw the gun when he was in the driveway. Essentially, both witnesses placed the officer at the same spot at that time that the witness threw the gun. So there is no contradiction. Moreover, this witness testified that her testimony put the officer much closer to the defendant than Sergio Sanchez's testimony, in that she testified she could only hear the events, and she testified first she heard a police command, followed by the sounds of running in her backyard, followed by a jangling fence that separated the backyard and the gangway. This sequence of events, the jury seized on that. In fact, the two jury questions that we had were on her testimony regarding whether or not she heard the police command before or after the sound of running. She clearly testified that she heard it, the command before the running. The importance of this is that the witness was testifying, or the officer was close enough to shout the police command before the defendant and the witness started running. So she is not contradicted, and the only person who contradicted the evidence here was Sergio Sanchez. I think the final analysis is that the defendant really does fail to properly account for the probative value of the evidence. He characterizes the gang evidence as only minimally probative, but that is certainly at odds with the testimony. The defense argument seems to sidestep consistently any sort of balancing, any Rule 403 balancing between probative value and the danger of unfair prejudice. He is able to point to several cases and say, look, these are cases where this court has held that gang evidence is prejudicial. The government concedes that gang evidence is prejudicial, but there must be a balancing. And the cases that he cites, the argument that he makes, it just does not address the probative value of the bias. And the gang case, the cases that he cites that do relate to gang evidence had little, the probative value of the gang evidence had little to no probative value. That's not the case here. The gang evidence was of central, the witness's testimony went to a central issue in this case. The gang evidence was central to showing the full extent of his bias. And unless the court has any further questions for me, I will conclude by asking you to affirm the judgment. Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Flanagan. Anything further, Mr. Fogarty?
First, I'd like to address, obviously, respectfully disagree with the government's characterization of how probative the gang affiliation evidence was. The testimony was, Mr.
So it makes lawsuits, people with different opinions.
Yes. The probative value of the evidence was minimal. Here, Sanchez denied that the gang had rules requiring him to perjure himself. The government had no other evidence that it did. Sanchez denied that the oath of loyalty that he took had any bearing on how he would testify or that any other members of his gang respect that oath.
But the jury was free to agree with him.
There was no...
I mean, they chose not to, right?
Well,
I'm not meaning to get you off this, but I think the point back here is, and I don't think the defense counsel was surprised that this came in. He just wanted to be the one that fronted it. And when he couldn't, I think that's became problematic for him. Otherwise, he would have fronted it. That was trial strategy.
And I think it became especially problematic because of the way it came out, like Your Honor mentioned, plus the repeated references to violence and other testimony. Those were not necessary to demonstrate any bias. This was more to inflame the jury. And with respect to the jury instruction, no jury instruction could have cured the prejudice inherent in this gang testimony and the gang references. There are cases in the Seventh Circuit, the Lagree case, and in the Ninth Circuit, the Marino-Balderrama case, where under 403, if the evidence is so unfairly prejudicial, no jury instruction could have resolved the error. And as I was mentioning, the real issue here is that it's not a single case of a passing reference to gang affiliation. This is half a large portion of Mr. Sanchez's cross-examination, and it's a close case. And thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Mr. Fogarty. And Mr. Fogarty, we appreciate your willingness and that of your law firm to undertake the representation in this case and the assistance you've been to the court as well as your client. Thank you. The case is taken under advisement.